Hey, and welcome back to the Six of Swords. This is episode 10. With us, we have Alan Drake. We will be talking about healing and music and all your favorite esoteric arts, from astrology to tarot to interdimensionalities. You know how we do here. So without too much further ado, this is the part in the show where those who donate $200 and above will get their names and messages read. They will also get the credit for the show, the executive and associative executive producer credits. And this is also the beginning, or the continuing of the beginning of the beginning of the continuing of the VFVRPG being developed over here at Six of Series Laboratories. That's Ethereal Laboratories as well. What we're talking about and more. So what we're talking about basically is the value for value role-playing game. As mentioned on the Six of Wands, there's a system that we are implementing over here, a game that is purchasable through points that you get when you donate to the show. You'll be able to buy armor, you'll be able to buy potions, you'll be able to upgrade your character in certain ways. And the characters that you begin through this series and that you can interact as over on the Six of Swords Discord, you'll be able to have go on campaigns. One of the things we'll be doing on the Six of Wands, actually, is instituting story mode, where you can pit your character in one-on-one battles, or for the more hardy of spirit, soul, and creativity, there will be campaigns to be gone on. So there's a blending going on of Dungeons and Dragons, Rune Factory Frontier, and Final Fantasy systems that we're implementing, and you'll find it's really unique because we're stepping beyond just doing a system that's based on numbers and typical means. You're going to see a whole bunch of great stuff. You're going to want to be part of this. You're going to want to listen to the show, get the lessons and the learning and the healing that comes from the show when you want it. And you're going to want to donate to make the show even better and to see the campaigns grow and to see your character grow. It's going to be great. I'm really happy with this. I get so many positive things coming in about this. And that being said, positive things, we also have an Invisibles reading group. If you're interested in joining us, head on over to the Discord Six of Swords channel and you can hop on, and we'll be having more information coming forward. The start date approximate is coming up at the end of October, beginning of November, around that nice heady Scorpio headless time. I should say loiny heady, but where's your head at? Which head? Anywho, so we'll have the Invisibles reading group going on, and there's going to be different interactive parts to that. There's going to be a special surprise. There's a whole bunch of great things that are going to be going on. So head on over to the Six of Swords Discord channel and check that out. For now, we have a great conversation coming up. I hope that you guys like this as much as I do. This is going to be a really good one. That's all I have to say. The intros, let the show speak for itself, right? All right, guys. Well, head on over to the Six of Swords. Donate through the occult fan at paypal.com, and I'll see you guys on the other side. 2-1. Hey, and welcome back to the Six of Swords. This is episode 10. And with us, we are blessed by having Alan Drake with us. And Alan is a musician and occultist currently researching Hellenistic astrology, Pythagorean harmonics, Hermeticism, and the Picatrix. Tarot and astrology are central to his practice, as well as sigil and image magic. Alan, welcome to the Six of Swords.
Hey, how's it going?
Man, it's going. nice to chat with you in this. You are a special, I'm not going to blow your age or anything, but I'm just fascinated by what digits you are. It's a very special digit. To me, I find it quite relevant. So why don't we kind of, you know, we'll let the more thinkity types out there kind of dig at what that is by this obscure beginning kind of thing I'm going to slide into with us. Have you listened to Fear Inoculum?
I've listened to bits and pieces of it. Duma and Tempest, I believe it is. Those are the two songs I've listened to the most.
What was the first one?
Numa.
Numa is the second track. Okay. I mean, there's two. It's okay, let's talk about this briefly. How do you
See, now what we're seeing is there's an album out. They're blurring the lines between what can an album be. Is it like, you know, you and I think of Dark Side of the Moon, and we know that's that track order. There's not like, oh, the bonus Bjork remix, right?
Right.
What do you think about how they released it this way? And do you have a way of discerning that you would say this is the proper quote-unquote album? Or, I mean, given that there's, yeah.
Well, to be honest, I really haven't spent any time with the album, so I don't really feel like I have much to say about it. It's I've heard some interesting ideas. Those are some long songs, but that's cool in its own way. Tool has gone in a very progressive direction, and my own music doesn't go that way. My research is more of a visceral approach to music. My background is mostly in the punk rock, heavy metal, and the blues informs a lot of what I do.
The blues, that's an interesting, in one of the songs, they actually lean into one of the most, like, I guess you would say it's kind of like, what's that when you would pay respect? You're like saying, this is where so
homage.
Well, I was thinking homage, but it's almost like kind of, it's like almost holy and sacred. They do this bar. I didn't count how many it is. You might think it would be like at least some iteration of 16 bar blues, because 16 is a 7, and there's that Tempest with the 7 at the, and 7 was right. The signature that they did so much of this in. And so that's like, one of the interesting thing is that they just leaned into this really obvious blues riff that Danny counted. Like, you expect it to fall off the rails at any time, but it's just right there. And it's like, you can't lock it in any more solid than that for a groove. When there's, right. there's no need for the panic or the fear of falling off the edge of that little bar.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, like, you're still so in it. Like, I can't even tell you, like, it's like a bear trap blues. You know what I mean?
So. It's a tension and release, and Tool are masters of manipulating tension and release.
They have good. Everything. Like, I mean, manipulating everything, like even the sounds in the background, you know what
oh,
I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They even play with the intonation of their instruments and the sounds that they're producing to create harmonic effects that you don't get normally with even-tempered instruments.
Maybe an example of that. That's I like where you're going. I love this.
Well, it's hard to give an example. Well, I've got something here. I'm not sure if the microphone will pick it up, but I've got an instrument, a harp that's tuned to a Pythagorean harmonics. And
oh my gosh!
It has a the way the harmonics work. That's, I'll play a E diminished minor seventh. And I don't know if it's coming over this microphone.
Yeah, oh, quite well.
But the effect is that the harmonic frequencies in a Pythagorean tuning with the proper intonation line up more precisely so that the waves are working together instead of out of phase with each other, or in a phase, a resonance phase that creates that kind of wow, wow, wow sound.
Yep.
If you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, that's the reason I play my Alice. My Alice is my acoustic guitar that you'll see me playing from time to time and
right on.
Time if I'm doing my music. And she has that whole, see the way that I approach, I'm excited to get into this. There's so much to going back to what you're saying. Very, very Japanese or Middle Eastern almost, that progression earlier just on the Pythagorean. I wanted to throw that in there.
The Pythagorean heptachord. It was a chord that was sacred to the Pythagoreans, and it was related to the harmony of the spheres.
We're going to dig into that in a second. The reason I play Alice is for that reason. I don't actually have the proper quote-unquote training, which up until... I mean, it's never hugely ever made me feel inferior as a musician, but like, I feel like what I'm going through now with my little quote unquote experiment, little and experiment in both quotes. I found that I'm more able to see that like what I was doing is being revealed to me as like way more cool. Pixies and Todd Rundgren and Kate Bush and people like this. You know, there's definitely training to some degree for Kate Bush, but are these people like Kate for Frank Black and such? So they're like, you know, some of my favorite musicians are not the people who go in there and know what they're doing with the classic kind of training. So what I'm bringing this around to is when I play Alice, I'm getting in the way I approach everything.
Yeah.
This is where I'm going with what I've said up to this point. To finish the point, I play her because I understand music through those harmonics. I understand the intensity, the pull, and the flow. I understand what I'm doing is a physical act that is not only, being so far in the physical medium, I am pulling a vortex through what I am doing. It's not so much manipulation of time or frequency or the spheres. It's everything we're about to talk about. It's the reason I do music. That's how I've always done it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's the big pull for music, that it's an emotional language that transcends speech. You know, if you play a major third anywhere in the world, that sounds like a happy, expansive sound.
I think that's such a valuable way to put it, because it actually shows that, like, for even people who say like, oh, you can't syncretize certain things. I mean, ultimately, oh my God, yes, there is so much syncretization going on because we are all built of the same. I mean, it's dangerous to say that you can't syncretize, because otherwise there goes the empathy and there goes the understanding that just because I'm tanner than you, maybe, and maybe not, you look like you have a better tan than me, probably where you are. But my point is on the continuity, it would say we're unbroken. We are whole. So it's the same thing for the syncretization.
The important thing to come to when you start getting into syncretization and the things it brings with it, like comparison, is to remember that people can arrive at ideas on their own and then meet up and compare notes and say, wow, we've come to the same conclusions. And it's not so much a matter of primacy of who developed the idea first, who expressed the idea first, but that we share these ideas.
Oh, for sure. Because, like, let's dig into this, because this is something that pokes at my mind a bit recently. Like, and there's more to say with the harmony of the spheres, let us remember. We have only so much history that we look into. We have about 2,000 years, depending on what system you use. Like, I'm sure in China they have a different year than we do.
Calendar systems are crazy.
Super crazy, dude. So, like, we're looking at, like, what we know as manifested history. Not only do we have such cut attention spans and the access and the echo chambers of the internet and that issue de facto, like an a priori issue now, but, like, a priori, history itself. How do we know, you know, it's not only that it's written by the victor, right? We don't even go down the Orwell tunnel of who controls it. It's just, like, how much, or maybe we are in a bigger way, how much history are we not even talking about? I mean, Chinese must have had what when? And what I mean? What's the real thing going on here?
That is interesting. And it's a thing that, you know, I think a lot of us are running into, you know, inside of the so-called Western tradition. You know, if you dig into it deep enough, you'll find, like, books in the Picatrix bringing in, that's from a very Arabic tradition, and it brings in Hindu ideas, Egyptian ideas, Greek ideas, Persian ideas into this great magical gumbo. And it really starts to beg the question, what is the Western tradition? You know, if India is part of the Western tradition, if the various Islamic and Arabic faiths are part of the Western tradition,
right,
then what are we all fighting about right now? Where is this division coming from?
Well, that's actually really, like, I mean, if we go all the way to the heart of that, that gets very serious very quickly, because we're talking about, like, the lack of our own selves facing what we bring to the world as incarnated vessels, choosing to have our souls in a darker, so-called, quote-unquote, thicker, more material place. We do come from a more infinite place, but because we need to, whatever the vessels are that manifest our light of our soul, this spirit body that we're in, there's dark and light in it, right? So, like, you know, this whole coursing of evil. And I find that this is a relevant topic lately. I'm surprised at people who think that this is so considered over and done with being, you know, understood.
The topic of ontological evil.
Right. I mean, come on, dude. It's like the trickster in of itself, but it's mm-hmm. beyond that, because the trickster can't even mess with evil. The trickster is a tool to the evil. The chaos is chaotic evil, because chaos is not evil. Trickster's chaos is nothing to do with evil.
Right.
The devil shits its pants when Satan comes to town, or however you right. put it, you know what I mean? Pardon my language. But anyways, I'm sorry. I feel like we're getting a little off the way. How can we connect? Ready? I think we can do this. I think this is going to be cool. I think it's pretty obvious, I guess, after we talk about it. How can we connect evil with the music of the spheres?
Well, that's the thing. The seven-string instrument that I just held up, it's a seven-string lyre, sacred to Apollo. It's sort of like a Greek tree of life, an Orphic tree of life. And each of the seven strings represents one of the seven planets. Okay. It's Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, the Sun, Mercury, Venus, and the Moon.
Each one feels like the planet that they are.
Isn't that interesting? And definitely. The relationships, the interval relationships between the notes describes their astrological nature. If I single out, say, Jupiter and Saturn.
Yes, please do. Oh, do it again.
That's a very dissonant interval.
Jupiter wants to go out and Saturn wants to pull in.
They're in conflict.
Yeah.
It became known as the Diablo of Musica, that kind of dissonance.
Oh.
Okay. And then if you bring in, say, something like Jupiter and the Sun.
Yeah. Ooh. Celtic-y.
Right. The harmony comes out. And that's a interval of a major third. Oh. And that scale is built around the concept of fourths and thirds. And I'm just scratching the surface on a lot of this. So
I understand.
I feel like it's almost like a musical thema mundi, which is an astrological concept, the birth chart of the universe. And this is the foundation for all of our modern music theory. Even though the intonation has changed, and they had to change the intonation to make modern musical instruments work. It's like Dr. Joseph Farrell said, it's like the universe handed us a problem, and by making a very small mathematical shift to the harmonic ratios, we opened up all 12 keys, and we could change keys and express ourselves with what appears to be limitless freedom musically. And that's thanks to Plato and his work with Pythagoras's harmonic mathematics, which are based around ratios.
I love Dr. F. I'm a geezer.
He's amazing.
Yeah. And people can't see, like, this is affecting me pretty profoundly. I've never understood. I've read Thrice Great Hermetica. Just because you read something doesn't mean you fully understand it. I am so that must be understood. Drost effect. But thank you for explaining it that way, because that pulls. This is exactly what I needed to hear right about now, and this ties into the seven and the seven. And oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. The Western music theory is built on 4-3. The intervallic relationships, intervals of 2-3, 3-2, inverting these ratios.
Yep.
It's really profound stuff. And it really does point towards not only an organization and a holographic principle behind the universe,
yes,
but freedom and liberty.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Dig right in, my friend, please.
Well, like I was talking about with opening up the 12 keys.
Yeah.
That, before we discovered what we call even temperament, which is that mathematical shift to the harmonic frequencies It's how we fret our guitars.
Yeah.
It's how we tune our instruments. It's what determines the ratio from 440A to the next note, like say 512C. That would be an even temperament. And all a right. different kind of temperament, like a just temperament or a Pythagorean temperament, changes that ratio. It changes those cycles, those hertz. It brings them in, moves them out, and lines up the frequency in such a way to bring out a quality. And from what I'm discovering with Pythagorean harmonics is they have a piercing clarity to them that is an intense aid in meditation. Mm. And I'm reminded of the Tibetan singing bowls that they use in their meditations and the chimes and gongs and things like that.
You know what's funny?
Frequencies are very, very similar.
You know what's funny is I'm going to see if my... Yeah, we're to the breaches with this one. I found an old album, an EP that I made of singing bowls from... Actually, I was at the store yesterday. I bought the Aquarian Tarot deck.
Oh, cool.
Long story.
It's on my list.
Is it? Oh, right on, yeah. Dude. Okay.
I don't have it yet.
Awesome. Yeah, there's always more. There's always. Yeah. There's, oh, my God. We could go on, but we're not going to because that's a black hole. That's a rabbit. There's that's a warren of rabbit holes, all right?
Yeah, I could fall down the tarot rabbit hole really all
right.
easy.
All right, let's bring it back in. Bring it, okay, we're pulling back to this. So we were going about the Enchanted Fox, and I found this old album I made of these, because they sell singing bowls there. It's a metaphysics shop, and they sell tarot. Although Walmart sells the Tarot Day, gosh, what is it? Why is the name? Casanova. Casanova. It's like super, I know it's super erotic and they actually apparently sell it on Walmart. Anyways, point is the metaphysics shop, they have glass singing bowls, the spirit bowls. Mm-hmm. And so those are all tuned to the same, you know, but they don't talk about it as planets. They talk about it as chakras. They talk about it as this is the sea. The sea is the Muladhara chakra, the red, the root chakra, primal, you know, it's, depending on how it's expressed, either fears or just sturdy instability. It's the brick. You need the foundation. Then obviously A, what is it? Let me make sure I'm doing this right. Is it, it's not C, is it? No, I think B. Let me try to remember. Anyways, it really isn't, I guess, necessarily right now to figure out what other people say it is. We're going to figure out which ones go where, what frequency pitches go with which. But it seems that the chakras, in some general sense, with what we call the planets, which I believe are the same thing as just the chakras in the celestial body of the sky or something to that metaphysical effect. I think that's what we're talking about, but that just ties it back around to, I found this old album. I'm just going like this with the rods. And I think it's just so crazy that I just found this old album, but I called like the songs like Ganesha and here we are talking about it. So cool, man.
Yeah.
Shiva. Yeah.
You know, Ren Collier, we're talking not long ago in a Discord chat. And,
I love Ren.
He's a great guy. And he was talking about how he wishes the West would get more on their game as far as an energy model goes.
Oh, yeah. Magic. We could definitely have a round table, you, Ren, and I, and maybe someone else talking about Tool and like the models, the new album when we get around to it.
And I posited the idea that music and music theory is our form of energy work in Western practice. It's just like just about everything else in Western practice is broken. We have to go back in and put the pieces back together. Like Gordon says, we have to, you know, figure out how the UFO works and put it back together again.
Well, the war on dreaming is exactly connected to that, because the dreaming is that more raw state where we're returning to that more connected, you know, less inhibited realm. So that if that's where the war is, then what we're saying is connected to what you're saying right there. I think it's important to, right? That's
you can see it in image magic too. Like in our society, you know, the pop culture, the images that are bubbling up to the surface, the conflict there. It's coming out of the dreaming, like you say. It's coming out of the subconscious. It's that 40 and dominant of witchcraft.
I think that's episode 8 of season 3 of Twin Peaks as well. I think that's what the metaphor is trying to say. I think that like our subconsciouses are now like uptick in UFO activity, as you mentioned. We need to know the UFO. Okay, well, we got our uptick in UFO. What's this about? Something about rituals, whether or not people agree that has anything to do with this, that, the other thing. Okay, well, we have that, sex, rockets, and, you know, maraschino cherries. And then we got the final thing. We got this whole warped, like, you know, in Twin Peaks, we're showing Bob and the vomit of the primitive, what might be like evil or Jote or whatever it is, or whatever that alien being is. But that's the alien vomiting all its negativity into this realm. So is that like the uninhibited, like, darkness of the shadow in the collective psyche, like puking in since like after World War II? Was World War II just so heinous that now we're all the evils vomiting? Was like the Holocaust?
Iconic yell to Bayoth.
Yo, yeah. Like the A-bomb, the Holocaust, whatever, really, right. I mean, no question, that happened. It was,
yes.
Should never happen again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have friends who have lost their family because of that, so, you know, it should never happen again. And it's a burnt offering. You know, it's important to understand that we're talking sacrifice. So, you know, whatever happened, it connects back to this episode 8, connects back to the, something primal is coming through, and we need more now than ever to heal. That's, oh, yeah. That's the crux. That's the word. That's the one.
Put it back together.
That's
absolutely. And, you know, I think Gordon's a real leader there as far as that goes. Gordon White with
Doubtless.
Synthesis on animism and permaculture, a form of metaphysics that we can live with together.
Extremely inclusive. You said it as exactly.
There's
it's real. Yeah.
There's we got to get analog. We got to get analog, and we got to get solar punk.
We got to figure out. You got to get and to get punk. Something you got to get in to get out. You got to get and. We'll figure it out. It's on. Put that in the to-do list. But yeah, right. Man, I agree with permaculture. I mean, I think we can sum it up into one useful kind of permaculture.
Solar punk, you don't have to go crazy. Just learn to grow something, you know, just start simple. And if you want to mix it up with a little bit of protective stuff, grow rosemary and thyme. That's great at keeping stray ghosts away.
Did you say strega?
Stray.
Oh, okay.
as in wandering.
Ah, I was thinking I was thinking about like how no one, hit, you know, I mean, take it from everything, Chinese medicine to strega to Indian, like, dude, curry is good. Hecate likes honey and so does Nate. So anyways, the point is that I think it would be good to like have a checklist for any cool permaculture apothecary, because like if we're thinking like communal wise, everyone should have something to bring to the potluck table too. So you're also healing yourself as well as others. And there's something about knowing that you're doing something for the larger body. Like, I bet you that my the blood in my finger is happy for pumping, just knowing that it makes the rest of my body able to live. There's something about the cohesive whole, appreciating the whole.
We're composite beings.
Yeah. It's an upward spiral of creation.
Right.
And
stated in the Corpus Hermeticum that we're made up of different levels of consciousness and different natures. And that's held up by modern science with everything from the biome in our gut to the divisions of our consciousness and modern psychology. We're composite beings.
Well put. We're going to avoid any Shrek metaphors with onions and stuff. But I think we just roundabout enough did it. That's true. I mean, well, as we say, that's true. I think that one of the important things is when we can use that layer metaphor to get through to what we need to guard in this war against our dreams, which is our subconscious. In fact, the bubbler that I was using earlier showing you has it's a can of box spinoff on Coca-Cola. So that image is right in my, here we go, Canna-Cola. And it's got all sorts, like on the back it says stoned facts, serving size, hella, amount per serving, what is it, one bowl. Calories.
Excellent. They went all the way.
Calories.
I love it when somebody goes all the way, you can tell that they're really committed to the idea.
Well, I think that they pride, yeah, in calories 420. Yeah, so they pride themselves. They pride themselves. That's the whole shtick. But anyways, but the whole point was the image magic. They're obviously knowing that it's powerful. It's powerful enough to be used for a mass mailing. What is this? A care package for stoners, right? Stoner care package.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's in our advertising. It's we're inundated in just images.
Are we going to talk about the Invisibles about now for this kind of stuff, sure, too? Yeah.
Oh, the Invisibles is a big piece of image magic. It's a huge work of image magic. And
it's like blam, 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 blam.
Right in my face.
I know. I'm holding up a Mind and Magic mug. But please, it's got tons of sigils all over it. That's why I interrupted. I'm sorry, Drake, please.
And did you do the Invisibles hyper sigil when he launched the comic?
I was reading it from the omnibus.
Okay.
So I just dove right in. I had read The Filth when the X-Files season 10 had come out, and then it was Twin Peaks season 3. I read the Invisibles, I believe, in Twin Peaks about the same time, which... Do you know what I'm making a motion?
That's got to be a hell of a pill.
dude. Yeah, you know, Miguel talks about a red pill suppository. I think I got the entire cafeteria at once.
Right on.
It wasn't Jell-O anyways. So
I was one of the people that was, I'm going to give away part of my age here. I'm a Gen Xer, and so I was reading it off the comic racks. And in the first letters page, he described the hyper sigil launch that he wanted to do at the book. And I was already on to Austin Osman Spare and his sigil technique. So I came up with my own intent, made my own sigil, and launched it with the death posture, you know, back in the old '90s days. And that launched one heck of a ride for me. I don't know about anybody else, but... a lot of things in my music career changed, took off, and all kinds of doors opened up for me. And the ride was going full steam ahead until 9/11. And when 9/11 hit, everything just seemed to shut down.
That's heavy. That's heavy as...
It was weird, yeah. But I mean, well, you know, just from a personal standpoint as a musician, the music industry, like the ideological and cultural tone in the country changed overnight. And from one moment, you're like a gutter punk rock band and that's cool and acceptable. And then all of a sudden, no, we don't want your anti-authoritarian, anti-establishment rock and roll stuff here. You know, gas prices skyrocketed. So that was our biggest operating expense, being a touring band that tripled, quadrupled overnight. And then, the music industry was also in a downward spiral due to Napster and crazy practices from the recording industry. And just, we all saw it. So, and it just things like there was a certain kind of mundanity that just seemed to inundate everything after that event. There is a sense in the 90s that, you know, we were winning and that we were going to advance together in this glorious new future where we had defeated history. And all of a sudden, in the space of a day, that ended completely. And it does. Apparently, there's no end in sight. We're not going to see an end to the security state anytime soon if we just sit on our thumbs and let things go down its path.
I think that's one of the things that music is able to do. I mean, like, cynically, it's able to give the world a Coke or, you know, heal the world, make it a better place, or Live Aid. And I love Pink Floyd and all that jazz, but you get my point.
Right on.
I think that, like, what we need to do is, like, and I think that's what's important about the message behind the Holy Gift itself, just to bust into that for a quick second, because it did not come through the channels of the record industry, right? It came through... Right. The people discovering it. It came through the subconscious. It came through a rearrangement. It's like, okay, well, there's a de facto, there is a structure. We need to build with either it's as simple as like we need to use our own wood or, hey, internet is okay for a permaculture community. There's going to be, we need, maybe I don't know how professional we can bring it, how much we can get control over all the resources we would need, like plastics or, you know, internets, or if we get past internets or what. But there's, you know, there, what I'm saying is that there are resources around us, but it's really up to us how we choose to interpret it, how we choose to live in the world around us. And it's like, this is the critical point about, like,
taking it back to the Invisibles. We put together our own little cells and we build our own parallel systems.
Exactly. I guess I was going to say, what do we do about, like, you know, the Myrmidons? Exactly. You know what I mean? That's right. What I guess that's what I was wondering. Yeah.
They're not going to go away if we ignore them. That's not how it works, I don't think.
I'm nodding.
But as far as, you know, excuse me, conflict goes, that's a tricky question, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Conflict resolution. And one of the things that I'm writing and working on is a kind of an Orphic space opera where the heroes don't rely on violence to solve problems. They rely on music and they rely on friendship and love and each other. And they're in a hostile universe that wants to divide them and hold them down. So, you know, I think that's what it's going to come down to. And, you know, to pull something from pop culture, and something that got a lot of grief, I think undeservedly, was the last Star Wars movie. And Rose Tico, a character that got a lot of hate, said, "We're not going to win by destroying what we hate. We're going to win by saving what we love."
I mean, that's true, though.
I think that was a wonderful point in the movie, delivered by a very cool character that I really enjoyed.
I mean, I can't, like, as a my pop culture, I mean, ultimately it's all bullshit, like our opinions about all these things ultimately, but like I joke that, like, if I ever ran for office, my platform would be that I'm going to just you know, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to fix the potholes, and I'm going to make it so that the only three Star Wars that are legally allowed to be known as Star Wars are 4, 5, and 6. That's my platform. How serious I take this. Well, I mean, I mean, let someone who's going to actually do the politicking do the politicking. I'm joking about that. But obviously, the idea is that, like, I don't like any of the other Star Wars as a kid who grew up with them. That was a critical thing for me. Yeah, you understand that for a long time, that story. And it, now this is interesting too, because this is all a lot pre 9/11. They rebooted it in 95 with the digital remaster version with that weird dinosaur. I'm like, that was necessary. That's your draw. Okay. But I can see an Ewok's face now. Oh, wow. So anyways, more Tauntaun guts. But the point is that the whole story really had, like, this real meaning to it. Like, you knew that blue-faced guy in the cantina's name, or at least what kind of alien. That was like a, now my brain's doing Moffat something? Muff-Tack. That dude's name is Muff-Tack. Yeah, right? What the hell? He has like a weird spidery face. He's cool. Anyways, so the cantina scene where the dude gets his arm chopped off, lobbed off by Kenobi there. So the whole thing was we knew it was Star Wars. But now I'm going on a really long nerd diatribe, but the idea is that it comes around to that. The new movies, even within, you know, I was a kid still when 2001 happened around. Whoa. We just did it. When did the new Star Wars come out?
The new Star Wars came out
after 9/11.
That's true.
That's true. It's a no agenda thing. People don't get it. You should listen to No Agenda. I'm on my podcast doing a shout out for other podcasts, but I think it's a good thing. Somehow I think it's a good thing. So these people are talking about how there's, like, this kind of, like, I don't know, even The Simpsons, but sorry, now I'm diverting. excuse me. So we were talking about image magic and we decided to divert, but
right. You go down the Star Wars rabbit hole.
So it was such a big thing because it talked about the archetype of the hero, but was this like 9/11, new Star Wars? Like, what are we talking about here? Where do we go with this? What do you think we can connect this to as far as how it's affected our psyche and the mass subconscious?
as far as Star Wars goes, resurrecting something like the Death Star and then destroying a whole star system was very 9/11. You know, that was a very 9/11 kind of thing where all of a sudden the whole, you know, you have this whole resistance thing going on. You have the whole First Order thing going on. And it looks like the tables are, you know, fairly evenly balanced. And then all of a sudden, in one moment, one side of the table is completely swept away.
Execute Order 66.
Mm-hmm. And that's the same kind of feeling, you know, that I remember from 9/11 was that, you know, it was like, it really did feel like the end of an era, and that whole paradigm was just swept off the table. And they were saying it right there on TV to everyone, this is the day everything changed.
WTC7 won't go away.
No. Did you ever see the reports that came out of BBC?
Naturally.
Showed World Trade Center 7 in the background behind them, completely intact. You know,
naturally.
On fire, but they were talking about how it already collapsed.
It was a tawny-haired, youngish middle-aged woman, about shoulder-length hair, wearing a dark sport coat, whatever, a woman's suit, I don't know, clothing. She was not nude. And she had a microphone, and she said the building had gone down, and as clear as day, unless that's a doctored video, that is the building still behind her, which indicates to any clear-thinking, rational human being who doesn't have their head so far up there, it means that there was a story that she's
reading
that was supposed to be about an event that had not actually happened yet. But the news is always real. Go back to sleep, citizens. Everything you know is true. Everything that you know is true. Everything that you know is true. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's pretty incredible, just the video footage. And it's important to add the caveat, unless that's faked. But I don't think it is.
Well, unless I'm experiencing some kind of weird Mandela effect or Mangala effect.
Yep, Mangala effect.
I remember those videos coming out on YouTube, and I remember watching the whole thing go down, and it all pretty much went down like that.
Yeah, I think it's a giant ritual, just like any other decent person would understand it to be. It's like
the biggest open secret in American society is that 9/11 in some capacity, in some fashion, is an inside job.
You know? I mean, what is an inside job but the person who was there and had access? It's never an inside job. It's just a shell game to the stupid. Well, anywho, I was a dumbass for a while. I'm still not as smart as I'll be in the future. I hope this isn't it. I like to think there's an upward trend here. That's what I'm doing anyway. So here's a thing though. Like, it was a ritual. It sounds like, you know, instead of like, you know, Sir Miles. Oh, well, let's not. Yeah. No spoilers. All right. We're doing an Invisibles reading group for anyone listening to the Six of Swords. You go into Discord, you find Six of Swords, join us in there, talk to us, yada yada. So this isn't a native ad. We're going to talk about 5G next. No, join the Six of Swords because we're going to be doing an Invisibles reading group coming up, and that's totally appropriate to mention here. Excuse me, guys. If you're interested, what we'll be doing is putting out more information through the Six of Swords Discord. For anyone who likes Invisibles, that's what you should do if you're listening to this. But to circle back around, so what do you think that this whole 9/11 ritual? It really feels like bad really tried to inject. It feels like another A-bomb almost. It feels like another 1947 as we described it earlier.
But like it's imprint on society. It's an abusive act, and it's just like an abusive act in the home. You know, it puts you in your place and it makes you afraid.
Yeah, how do you train fleas kind of thing, right? You
can only jump with frogs.
And since we are infinite consciousness that is all together in one giant consciousness, on Malkuth to operate the most effective curse against the mindset, you would actually use particularly potent symbols such as a twin pillar candle. Burning it down would be what you're... I mean, that's not the best example. Maybe it is. But what I'm saying is that there's so many different archetypes that happened in 9/11. And I think the twin pillar candle is one of the best ones. I want to add a caveat. Here's something. I want to see your opinion on this. That same stoner care package can of box is doing a theme this month. They did like road trip. Then they did soda shop. Now, I want to see what you think about this, because I had to think about this. They're doing Empire as their theme. And I just know that they had a whole bunch of these Empire papers. And like, how can we sell these? Oh, dude, make it the theme. All right. Hey, it's September. So here's what the email said. A theme dedicated to New York's most iconic building. That's September's Canada Box theme. What do you think about them doing that?
Yeah, September, most iconic building. What else could it be?
I know. It's the Empire. It's obviously the Empire State Building.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's obviously not a connection. Right. I mean, dude almighty. That's some chutzpah. I'll say that. That's some chutzpah to do it like that. That's how they're going to do it. They're like, oh, man. Oh, yeah, we all know that 9/11. Oh, you know what we can... But at the same time, now as a different angle, I'd be like, it's kind of nice, though, that maybe they're kind of trying to soften the angle. Maybe it's, you know, teaching us to not look at all the pip cards the same way. You know, so maybe that's an interesting positive thing that is doing. Maybe they're healing the psyche.
Could be.
I don't know. You know, I don't want to... I'm not judging. I'm just saying that's interesting.
Excuse me.
Yes.
That's an interesting point. And it's hard to talk about some of these ideas sometimes. I feel like I'm talking, like all of us are talking circles around something that we can't see, you know?
Yeah.
With the whole, there's an upwelling going on. It's that healing, as far as like the Myrmidons you were talking about.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that.
That's what this whole conversation or corner of the conversation is about.
Yeah.
Is, how do we deal with this conflict that we have with this force, this archonic force that does things like knock down the towers and start decade-long wars and wants to imprint empire permanently on our world.
Yeah, I mean, it's the microcosm too, with like rape and abuse of women or children, or I mean,
well, we have allies. Yeah. We oppose the Myrmidons, we have our own allies. And in my practice, that would be saints and ancestors.
Well put. Other people might call them spirits or, you know, whatever. Like, I think that you're right, though. I think that in the traditional way of, like, maybe how we always could understand things, that there's good guys, bad guys. I mean, there really does seem to be that real archetype happening. It's obviously at play in our real lives. So
yeah,
people are so distracted, but we really, really need to realize, I think, that whatever we call morality, you know, the easiest way to make people eat their vegetables is to make it cool to do that. So ultimately, we need to make being a good dude or a good chick or a good whoever you are to be a moral person, to be a cool and good thing that we just, even if it's hard, man. You know, so it's like realistic. It's never, but utopia is hell. Hell is utopia. And my point by saying that is to say that nothing's ever going to be perfect. There's always...
No, I don't buy into any transcendentalism.
Right. Yeah, this, I mean, we still got a shit. I mean, that's a fact. So the point is that, like, yeah, it's a realistic, we got to make realistic virtue and morality and being Pythagorean tempered or feng shui in our soul.
Yeah.
you know, to be a, and that's what comes back to the holy gift. It's like, there's certain trials you're going to go on, you're going to have to undergo. But if you can go using the trivium and the quadrivium at your disposal, so you have a way to orientate yourself around the ideas, if you keep the idea of ultimately that we are unified and that the ultimate battle is against the schism, and that next that you have to use nonviolent means to do, so that's track four, Ticks and Leeches, is the nonviolent communication aspect of it. It's like, for anyone who comes at you, I hope you suck. You know, you can't, no, Drake, let's say, I like that because you're, ooh, it's such a good name. When you get the person coming at person A and person B, you get person A who's just chilling. Person B is a parasite. Person B comes up and just like starts interfering with them on a metaphysical level. Like star A is just chilling. So star A has every right within the system that we're talking about, this realistic system of morality, this realistic, understandable, you know, maybe it's time that like, maybe they reset the Nintendo button with 9/11. And now we got to be the adults who can make a future that's reasonable. And I think Gordon's a huge part of that. I think you and I, dare I say, are a huge part of that. That's like trippy to say. But anyways, get past the self, because the self isn't even there. I'm just trying to play the role right now, right? So when we're doing this, we realize that it's like star A is chilling. Star B comes up and interferes, right? He initiated that shit, right? So star A has every right to say, fine. You want to, I mean, this skips through several layers of thinking, but it comes to this is the right response. If you're going to come at me and try to suck from my life's energy, and this is just like what the hostility is in that song, this Ticks and Leeches, people listen to it. If you're going to come at me, give me that hostility, give me that whatever. You know, I have every right. I can't thrash out at you, but ultimately I can paradigm it as such. I am a sentient entity. You are now a parasite. You are sucking off of me. Fine. You want this? It's like when a mosquito lands on your arm and you pop it.
Sure.
It's a legitimate thing to do in nature. That's not bad karma. You did nothing wrong. That's the example. How about that? And that's why it's ticks or leeches. If you squeeze so much into them, that's what they came to get after all. So you know what? You want it? I hope you choke. It's it's judo. It's some kind of it's a karmically legitimate anti-betrayal conceptualization of nonviolent communication.
Banishment,
my brother. That's straight up it. Thank you. Make it simple. But so then it goes on from there throughout the album. And that's you know, we all can tie this around, because I think Tool right now is proving that they're pulling. I think that, and I'll give you know, well, we all have our own thoughts, but I'll definitely, one thing my girlfriend said, Rhonda Blanc, Rain de Blanc, the White Queen. One thing my White Queen said was that, that sounds like that he's really stepping into his role, Maynard specifically, in using the platform that the music has offered, is stepping into a guide role. Like if this were the last Tool album to ever exist, he pulled off the necessary kind of teacher aspects that he needed to. He took his position as that level in our culture. He's an orator in a Senate in Roman times right now, as far as the archetype that he's playing in our culture, as far as affecting what matters. Because now the plebeian and the you know, I don't know if like the super elite get different internet and different music than we do. You know what I mean? So he's affecting the mass mindset, and he stepped into his role, she's saying, as a I'm using the word prophet, but just teacher role, you know, poet, someone who's going to hopefully have the best impact ultimately on society in the Absolutely. Upward evolution.
And I think that is what the role of a prophet is.
Yeah, I'm on board. I think that's, I think she's onto something. And I think, yeah, this album's going to take some time. Like, I mean, it really, it's I made a joke about taking all the red pills at once. I mean, it's just it's a very well made it's surreal, because like you're like, it's not only is it surreal because now it's suddenly there after so long and blah blah blah, even though the real album is like 5 years, not 13 or whatever, all that. It was typical Tool album time pretty much. Mm-hmm. Sans the fact that I guess they use some Anima riffs and whatever, that's really cool, because it's like, treat your riffs right. You know, treat your art right. You never know how it can come around and be important that way, as a lesson, even meta. But the idea is that, like, what they're doing is like somehow signaling to those of us who are hopefully adult enough and aware and can speak this language to become aware of our own responsibility towards our own conscious betterment, just as individuals, and like the traffic jam, not yelling or positioning your life so you're never in traffic jams, mm-hmm. delegating that somehow other way. The idea is to become so strong inside yourself that what you do is then able to affect others around you in that positive way. And as an adult, we are going to have to be taking up the mantle in this world. So I hope that what we're saying right now can all, as one kind of giant thing that we're walking around talking about as a giant tower, I hope that as an elephant, that that we can say that, you know, people, what they take away from our conversation, which is, you know, we're not over, we're just right here. And I got to take a, well, anyways, before I do all the part where I have to edit out, people are still listening to us. I hope that people are listening to, like, how, you know, it's cool to be a stoner. Just use the cannabis to be effective in your life. It's about what you can produce. It's about what you bring to the table, sure. as well as treating yourself well. We're not all so precious. We have a responsibility to others. That's where we're going with this conversation, I think.
I think so.
Sorry, go ahead.
The responsibility to others is a responsibility to ourselves. That when we take care of the people around us and the people that we love, we're taking care of ourselves.
I'm beaming from ear to ear. I think my jaw is like floating above my eyes right now. I don't know how that's possible. It's like I just went full Cheshire Cat. I agree with you 1001%. That's giddy tingles, GT there. I believe it's true. I believe it's true, though. I think that's why I think it's one of the reasons I'm doing this. What do I say that the Six of Swords is about? But art, spirituality, and healing. That's the little thing for the show.
Absolutely.
I liked it because it spelled ash. I totally thought about how Phoenix is, you know. So it's like if you can listen to the show and it's the fire that burns some, you know, it's one of the things that helps add to you as a tool. It's like the fire that helps burn. You can leave it behind afterwards once you've transformed.
Right on.
Wow. I'm totally making this up as I go along, dude. But so the same
sure,
thing with this.
Let's ramble, man. Let's ramble.
Well, would you
it
mind?
Sounds a lot to me like metempsychosis, you know, the migration of the soul. The soul has a journey. Part of it's incarnated here in this body and this life. But there are times before now, and there will be a time after now, where my soul will be off doing other things and other existences. And perhaps it returns to this place, perhaps this time, perhaps another time. I'm not sure. I don't think anybody really knows for sure. But yeah, as we go through this journey, through this metaphysical drama, we choose the parts we play. And the parts we play spin out into a narrative. And that narrative becomes the world around us. And so it's important for us to choose narratives that nurture what we love and nurtures the world that we live in.
I agree. And that's the definition of sanity to me, frankly. I mean, I don't know why I just kind of made, like, again, I'm making this up as I go, but that really does seem like sane and good behavior. And anything that would be against the natural law would seem to be cancerous or at some bad angle that we need to smooth out.
Or at least a misunderstanding. I feel like a lot of harm comes from bad spirit packs where one side or the other, or perhaps both sides, didn't really understand the actual deal that they're negotiating.
Student loans?
Student loans, or, you know, you can look at cotton farming and the history of cotton farming. You know, cotton's a great benefit to society. It creates bandages and clothes and textiles and so on. It has a history that goes all the way back to Egypt. And the story of cotton moving across the world is also the story of colonization and slavery. And perhaps we got that result out of that interaction because we did not negotiate properly with the spirit when we were setting up our initial practices. that the slavery is baked into the big agriculture model of cotton, and that if we had maybe found a different approach to the farming and living with and working with that spirit, its wake through history would not have caused so much bloodshed and heartache and trauma. And we all live with that trauma. It's all part of us still to this day.
Well, that's the thing about trauma too, is that it's the same thing as a misunderstanding, in that it's a static waveform in which should otherwise be a peaceful wave. And it's a Diablo a Musica, but without it's an overexposure of Diablo Musica. I'm almost sure that needs to exist for some purpose, but
well, those tensions create the opportunity for the release, which is the beauty of a melody. The blues chord, a diminished minor seventh, is a unstable chord that allows you to move from one place to another almost effortlessly. But it's that instability creates that sadness, creates that pain. And in that pain, in that fragility, in that fall, you find grace.
I believe that's the point in the calendar that I'm born at, is that point where the sun starts to go into that phase, solar calendar-wise. That's why it's called the fall, of course, because the sun enters its fall in Libra.
Yes.
But that's a beautiful way to describe it. You have quite an understanding on you and about you, I should say, because ideas have people. Not so much do we have just ideas.
Absolutely.
I think it's not even fair to say it's a two-way street. Both things are happening. It's both and, but then there's like, you know, you have the free will to like one of the things I showed you, a mind and magic mug I have. That's right. Frater Xavier. And one of the things he taught, first things that he, foundational lessons back when I first am getting into magic, 2014, 2015, he teaches that ideas come into your head. You can choose to accept them or reject them. Now, this is beginner practice, right? Basically, but okay, so blah, blah, blah. Oh, negative thought form. Hey, that doesn't jive with what I want. That's either this, that. It's where you're at morally and all this other stuff. It's all that. But you say, okay, well, I banish that thought. And then you can either replace it with a good one, because often my other teacher at the time, Uncle Birch, says, when you banish, you must invoke. So if you're going to, nature abhors a vacuum. You banish that. That's great. Now what's there? Well, you better fill it with what you want, creator. You know what I mean? Otherwise, you're going to spend all your time banishing. That's my addition to it. But it's just like, yeah, just fill it with, you know, so otherwise, yeah. So, you know, you banish something and you say, okay, and then something good comes and you accept it. It's about strengthening a kind of metaphysical attractivity to whatever, more likely percentage-wise, things that are going to come to you.
Yes.
I think, maybe.
I think so, too. And it's one of the reasons why I'm not so big on hard banishings anymore.
Yeah.
Because of that antiseptic spiritual vacuum you're talking about.
Oh, right on, dude. Yeah, it's like eating, it's like the pharma version, where it kills your biome instead of where you just eat like freaking ginger and holy schnip, your sniffles went away. Or I don't, that wasn't medical advice, people, but here, kid, eat this Thai, Ryan. No, but anyways, the idea. I don't know, man. My subconscious has been having a lot of fun lately. So anyways, here's the thing. Yeah, right? Jesus. Jim Carrey, right? But I was thinking of the 1993 movie The Mask for some reason. I think that luck must be coming to mind. Anyway, so excuse me. I just totally got on an excursion there. But yeah, I think that the power of what we're doing by banishing and invoking and having a clear mind and having the ability to like practice, you know, not just like, oh, like a lawyer being able to go over every word or this, that, but to have meaningful communication that is at a sufficient
axis.
And
yes, it's the communication. That's what the image is. That's what the words are all about, is communication.
And that's the banishing and the invoking in your own mind, the ability to have a clear enough mindset so that your interpreter guy, your perception state thingy doodly thing, bopper stuff, is able to clearly at least have a shot at resonating within the realm that you can't see infrared, you can't know what a magnet is besides experiencing its ability. But for all the other things that you do have perceptual grips on, mm-hmm. y'all be able to interpret it most efficaciously. And this goes all the way up from basic, like, cognitive strengthening to, like, eating gold powder to, like, you know, really, like, crazy high-level stuff. Like, people be thinking, like, I feel stupid standing next to some of these people that are, like, processing, like, 18 different things. I'm like, oh, man, I need coffee. You know what I mean? So it's like, that's how crazy it gets. It's not just, like, IQ. It's EQ, and it's all your... You know, how much can you future, like, how connected to the Akashic Records is how my rant is ending right now.
Right.
You feel me? Like, that's what I'm saying. It goes, like, what do you think about that?
With the Akashic Records?
All of the precursor with the banishing, the evoking, the clear mental state, but also then how high, like, we can clear our mindsets and this, that, the other thing.
So here we are at the halfway point, the mid-tro. This is the part in the show where those who have donated between 200 or right under 200, 199 to 0.99 to $50 and above, we'll get their names and notes mentioned, and we'll get credit for any of the gear or anything they're trying to buy. Of course, this is the VFVRPG, value for value role-playing game that we are developing over here at the Six of Series. Besides that, you'll also find that this is the point where we're going to get back into some of the questions the show likes to ask, the six of the questions. We switched topics from talking about the accessing of the Akashic Records. We started to delve into wanting to talk later about how that relates to harmonics, living in harmony, how Pythagorean students learned how, for years, how music worked before they got into the deeper mysteries. And there's a lot more that we have to talk about. For this conversation, we shifted gears into some of the questions and some more of the lighter fare. So for now... So my first question is actually a pretty obvious one for a musician. And you know, I do the what is your favorite? So of all your musical things, digging in throughout your life and all of the changes, your favorite musical act is what?
Well, it's a tough one. It would probably have to be Blue Oyster Cult, but a real close call for Black Sabbath. But Blue Oyster Cult, I just have a deep connection with that band going way back to when I was a kid, and they released Don't Fear the Reaper as a single. And I remember the first time I heard that song sitting in the back seat of the car, and I just started bouncing up and down, telling my mom to turn the radio up, and I was just all on fire. And I remember them being really kind of nervous and uncomfortable about how excited I was about this song about, you know, the Grim Reaper and death and all these, by this crazy band, Blue Oyster Cult. Those, and for some reason, yeah, they've just always been a big part of my musical interests.
They're very occult, of course. I mean,
oh, yeah.
They had the Thoth deck on the cover of Agent of Fortune, right?
Agent of Fortune, they had a guy that looks a lot like Jack Parsons.
Not Jack Parsons, do you think? Yeah, it does look like Parsons, doesn't it?
That's what I've always thought.
There's a Thoth deck on that. If you look at it, he's holding up a few different major arcana from the Thoth deck. The free.
I never noticed that it was the Thoth deck. I've always had it like cassette tape, so the album artwork was real small on the cassette tapes, and the cards were very hard to make out.
Understandably,
on a vinyl cover, it's you can see it a lot better.
Yeah. That's one thing I never had. Well, I mean, I didn't grow up with them, but I noticed it more recently. I was like, oh, I've seen that a few times, and I know to look, and oh, those are tarot cards, and oh, you know. So, Blue Oyster Cult, I find it interesting that we've been talking about the Saturn and Jupiter stuff, and you bring up...
They're very Saturnine.
Well, I was going to say you bring up a band with blue, and then you bring up a band with black, right, in their titles. So you bring up the black and the blue right off the bat.
Right.
That's a charming synchronicity, and it leads us into our second question. Just via the fact that it's a question, this is a fun one. I think. What's your favorite dish, like food?
Oh, the one I eat the most is probably ramen noodles.
But what's your favorite? If you could like have anything without going crazy Garfield cat and eating it always, like if you could just have your favorite, what would it be?
Oh, let's see. That is such a tricky question. I would probably, it'd probably be gumbo, Cajun gumbo.
Is there a particular kind of meats and types in there that you would have?
Well, it's gumbo is always like a local cuisine, so it uses the local foods. So here, that would be like Kaneka sausage, chicken, shrimp, crab, that sort of thing. Oh. But I quit eating it because it has stuff like crab and oysters and shrimp in it ever since the oil spill in the Gulf. I've just been a little bit wary about eating things that come out of there.
Did you ever see the old cartoon Homestar Runner?
Yeah.
So do you remember Teen Girl Squad?
No, that doesn't ring a bell.
Teen Girl Squad was one of the cartoons that Strong Bad drew himself, and one of the characters just goes, "I'm hesitant." So that's what that reminded me of when you were saying you're hesitant to eat the gum, that particular type of thing. I was like, oh yeah, I can understand that because of the mercury and the oil spills, and you basically absorb what the fish absorbs. So I understand that completely.
Especially the crustaceans, the crabs and the oysters. And that's the stuff that makes the gumbo really good. So it's like,
what's the point, right?
Well, yeah.
It makes me think of is a cross-cultural comparison. I was thinking about what are those things? You get those huge bowls at a Thai restaurant. You know what I'm talking about? Like, it's not a scorpion bowl, is it? It's something different than that. But it makes me think of gumbo. It's like, wow, that's actually a very similar kind of idea. A bunch of different meats. And, you know, I'm like, oh, yeah. I wonder if you could, like, find the planetary equivalent of culinary archetypes. I mean, that's what they probably tried to do with describing, like, the 777 and all of the, peppers are Mars. You know, I don't know. I don't know if we're stepping into that territory by doing that.
Skinner, Dr. the incredible Dr. Skinner.
Yes.
And his magnificent book of tables has all kinds of food correspondences, plant correspondences. So, yeah, we've talked about that in some other circles, discussed the idea of a magical cookbook drawing on those correspondences, and, you know, elections for cooking the dishes and things like that.
That'd be good too for like ritual food and offerings. Like, I mean, obviously the implications are manifold.
Sure.
I mean, it's man of food. Man of food. Yeah. Anyways, manifest that man of food. More questions. I have more questions. What is your favorite or most? You can understand this however you want to, but your favorite special magical place in this world?
It's not really here anymore because of the way the coastline has changed due to hurricanes and building condos and stuff like that. But there was a lagoon down on the beach with a pass, and I had an experience there, and yeah, that place was very special to me. And I still go back there on journeys. I journey there often. But as far as it being a physical location that I go to these days, it's just not the same anymore.
Man, do I not know how you feel? And it's little things too, even like in a town. It doesn't even have to be your favorite spot in the world. It's just industrial is, it hurts the heart, you know. I feel you. But that's nice that you still go there, and it's even cooler that it's a lagoon. For some reason, that kind of area really resonates with me. I like that.
That kind of interpenetration of land and earth, of sea and earth. And
I knew what you meant. Exactly. Yeah. It's liminal in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Watching Bed Knot. So my mom and my girlfriend have the birthday like a day apart. It's kind of crazy. It's
that's cool.
Tracy Twyman and Liz Frazier. So the 28th and 29th of August. And we were just watching, we began most of Bed Knobs and Broomsticks, but she lives on the sea, right? The Angela Lansbury character in Bed Knobs and Broomsticks, all about using witchcraft to fight the Nazis, which mm-hmm. is almost a kind of cool metaphor for what you and I are talking about right now.
Right.
Aptly enough, as mm-hmm. this thing is wont to be. This is why crucifying the ego in a reasonable way is important. Yeah. We're not, dude, this is cool. Like, life is cool. Like, you got to realize, like, it that we even exist. This is fun that this stuff happens. And synchronicity doesn't have to drive you crazy. It's not like everything's, it's just like, stuff's happening, man. Just get with the program. There's a bigger Anyways, actually, screw the program. Get away from the program, I guess is what we're saying. Mm-hmm. But you got to get in to get out. Or something like that. You got to know what you don't want to know that you don't want it, or something like that. I don't know. Do you agree with that? Do you agree that you have to know what evil is so that you don't do it?
I think we know evil when we see it in the moment. You can feel it.
Yeah.
Because so many things are about context, you know.
Hugely.
One of the things we talk about in some circles that I talk in is, when is it appropriate to use Malefica? You know, when is it appropriate to curse somebody or summon a spirit descended after somebody for something, you know? When is it the right time to do that sort of thing? And the phrase I heard somebody say is, you know, well, when you see their fingers coming over the walls, you hit them with the hammer. It's all about the context. When they're coming for you, when your back's up against the wall, when you don't have any other recourse, then maybe you can look towards some of those kinds of actions. But
yeah,
in the moment, you'll know.
I think it's extremely reasonable. I mean, it is very contextual, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like there's a way to say that, like, you know it when you see it. I think there's something to knowing evil so that you can combat it. Because if you know it when you see it, that's one thing. But, like, evil is such of a machination that it works in invisibility.
Mm-hmm.
And it's – this is a very complicated topic, and this is something that I'm still grokking myself. So, but, yeah, basically one concept is that, like – you know, yes, it's pretty obvious what evil is, but then the contextual thing, and I don't know, this gets my brain shutting down kind of right now. But the idea is that, like, I think that you answered that pretty much similarly that I would within the realm of, like, we want to do good no matter what that is, but isn't good just a different vantage point? Or are there a set of harmonics in a way that nature shows us, that nature grows, that we can live in accord with and treat each other as such, so that, you know, do good fences make good neighbors? What if those people's fingers are coming over Trump's wall? Do they have the same response? You know what I mean? So there's so much to it. There's so much to it. It's like, I want open borders. Well, give me the keys to your apartment, please. You know what I mean? Like we said, it's just like, it's as above, so below. We have to look at what the rules are too. So
like
I think,
a good medicine, you have to have the proper proportions and ingredients, you know, and one of those ingredients by itself or in the wrong proportions may kill you.
Yep. It's too much of a bad note. There's too mm-hmm. much in the song. Yeah, to bring the music back. Right. A poison is too much of an intensity of one particular thing for the body to process, and it just
sure, it's a dissonance.
Yep. And it shuts down, or it ceases to be a suitable vessel for a soul.
But it can set up a situation for another harmonic. You can create that tension, and then you can release that tension with a more harmonious harmonic.
And, that's true.
Pythagoras discussed it in these terms, or Nicomachus the Pythagorean. He said he was quoting Pythagoras, but he was centuries after Pythagoras. And one of the philosophies behind this is that music is proof that the ear can apprehend the beautiful, you know, the good. If you want to relate beauty and good, you know, because the good is a difficult topic, but beauty is something that we apprehend.
Oh yeah. I'm a Libra sun. I am obsessed with beauty. I am a 00-degree Libra sun. I am a literal equinox baby. And my point is Libra beauty. Even though there's some chaos about me, mm-hmm. Anyways, my point is truth is beauty and beauty is truth. And the same thing goes with the good. I really believe that we know this to be true.
And they knew that these harmonies were created by mathematical relationships.
Yes,
they knew the number was at the core of this.
That's why it's rational.
Even though they didn't have a method of measuring, say, like how many vibrations make a pitch. You know, right. They didn't know 440A or anything like that. It was all about the relative harmonics of two notes. So that is one way you can know evil, I guess, is in your relationships and in the harmony of your relationships. And if your relationships, whether it be with another person or the land or your work, if there's dissonance in that relationship, then there's something wrong. And maybe we can quantify that wrongness as an evil. And, you know, the answer in a lot of cases probably isn't to go in with the sword and root it out, you know, but to modify it somehow, adjust it, bring it into harmony.
Yeah. I mean, the mystics are shown as like enchanting, like the super, like the really powerful magician white brotherhood are often depicted in at least one way we can see them as those kind of like they're going around and they rebalance the harmony of the area. It's not so much about good. They nullify the harm. They reassert its natural order, mm-hmm. the natural law of the area, because things were good already. God created things perfectly, basically. I mean, the grand architect had the right design. It's up to us to not let whatever the malfunction, you know, it's up to us to rejigger the system. Saving the world is just like when there's a problem, fix it. You know, we're really out of whack right now. We've let the virus take control. So cymatics.
And we can find we can find those imbalances, those dissonances just by, you know, feeling where it's uncomfortable in those relationships.
It's feng shui too, I think, is another thing that was important to add in there is this. It's we can see it from the Eastern side of things. I mean, there for relationships in there, I mean, they have a caste system as far as we're talking about. So like that's a different way of understanding because they are very, and we're just blanket statements, people, but to understand it, the society system is a lot more like Europe.
Really outside of my areas of expertise.
Well, basically, it's not hard to say that we understand that a typical system in this case would, despite having feng shui, would have a top-down and very regimented, almost pedigree or caste system, and that the individual is often much more likely to be subjugated to the mass, unquestioningly. And whereas in the West, we at least have this illusion that we're not, or we aren't, and maybe the problem is we need to meld that with the freedom of the West so that we have the responsibility to the society with the willingness to do it in the first place, which is basically voluntarism.
Yeah, direct action and community action is what I see as far as going forward. And that requires living in harmony with things and, being a good neighbor.
Yep.
And I'm not talking about liking your neighbors. I'm just talking about if they come over for a cup of milk and you have a cup of milk to spare, you can give them a cup of milk. And that doesn't mean you have to love them. You know, that doesn't mean you have to get along with them. But when the chips are down and when it comes to really being there for each other, I think it's in our nature that, you know, you could be laying in a ditch and the guy that pulls you out might be an ex-con, you know?
Yes. And that's the whole thing too. I mean, like Oedipus meeting the king on the road and stuff too, right? You never know who's who and like what stage in the journey they're at. Do you, what do you think free will is in this whole charade of the dream of life, right? How does that work?
We got to have something to pit against fate and fortune, I guess.
So is it like night and day exists? So like free will has to exist because fate and fortune exist? Or is there no duality there? I don't know. Forget that duality thing. How do you mean?
For a long time, my practice was centered around the whole idea of will and that very Golden Dawn, Aleister Crowley idea of projecting my will into the world as a form of magical force and bringing things into alignment. And for a long time, I thought I was kind of terrible at it. Like I would get things going, but they would blow up in my face and stuff like that. You know, I was like, I was getting results, but I wasn't getting the results that I expected or wanted. And recently, a few years ago, I started really getting into astrology and studying my natal chart. And according to my natal chart, there's much in there that rings true, but there's some areas where I managed to potentially dodge bad fates. And looking back in over the course of my life, it's not so much that I was bad at magic. It's just that I was directing a lot of it in areas that weren't my fate. I was trying to force my way and push my way into things and activities and ways of being that are, I'm going to get astrological, aligned with my south node. And those are the things that are part of your past fate, according to a lot of practices.
You were swimming in the wrong direction.
The north node is where I needed to direct myself, which is the home. And that's pretty much where all of my attention is these days.
So you have a fourth house north node?
Yes.
Makes sense. Oh, that's powerful.
It's angular, so it's been a very forceful effect in my life.
It's an area in a podcast that I feel like we don't have to, that's more like that's your home. And I respect that kind of thing. I wouldn't even quite frankly, as someone who's still in his 30s and doesn't even really, I'm not even married yet. So that's a whole other understanding of what it's like to the magical nature of creating that space, that reality, that story, you know, telling that myth and being the myth maker in the myth, right? That's, you know, man, you got something in that fourth house. You probably have a good story or something to teach through there. So I don't know. What do you think?
I'm working on stuff. I don't have anything ready yet, you know. Maybe one day I'll have something to publish. Most of my work is of a solo and practical nature. And a lot of it is private. That fourth house north node effect coming in, you know, so it's difficult to talk about and end up talking around it a lot, but it's interesting. I can say that it is centered on ancestral remediation work.
How valuable that we have a teacher like Gordon to come along and even spark that conversation.
Exactly when I needed it. I was at the end of my rope when I ran across Gordon. I've been bashing my will against everything for so long, and I was literally at my wit's end. I had no idea how to proceed, and it was letting go. And it's funny, it took me all the way back, full circle, all the way back to Austin Osman Spare,
yep,
you know, my big hero back in the 90s. And he talked about riding the shark of desire, which is like completely opposite of this whole idea of manifesting your will in the realm of materiality in accordance with these precepts and ideas. It was finding this gateway into your subconscious and riding into your subconsciousness and being carried away by the images and the personalities that you encounter there.
I believe that Osman Spare and a figure like Bruno and a figure like Herschel, those three figures would be kind of like the three historical figures I could associate with my understanding of Gordon.
Cool. I'm not very familiar with Herschel, but Bruno is, I love Bruno. He is huge.
I'll bring that together. So now you'll love Spare, Bruno, and Herschel. Gordon wrote an article with the title "Much Have I Traveled in the Realms of Gold," or "Much Have I Traveled in the Realms of Gold," I believe it was. And he basically, the long and short is, just like Bruno blew open the universe by saying, "My universe is infinite. Mine's vastly bigger than you can imagine." That kind of thing.
Right.
And the same thing with Osman Spare riding the shark of desire, or even as we're stripping the pips of their meaning in that way. Basically, to bring it to Herschel, Gordon wrote about this German mathematician and musician. So I'm pointing at Drake and I, but this as Marty Leeds would, mathematician. But so basically what we're looking at is like this guy who's in this English garden, and they tell him that Saturn's the end of the universe, and he makes his own telescope, lives with his sister, who would have been doomed to spinsterhood, but he's cool, treats her as a peer. They work together. She ends up discovering like comets or whatever, named after her. Anyways, the point is that he, with his own telescope that he made, you know, talk about solar punk DIY, he with his own, you know, sky tech, he with his own telescope discovers Uranus. So Herschel's glyph on your zodiac, mm-hmm, is an H on the Uranus. It was originally called Herschel. That's how people learning astrology will never forget. That triple prong one's obviously Neptune. That other one with the H is Herschel, now called Uranus. So by doing that, he exploded the universe Bruno style, and he rode that the style of Osman. So these three, I definitely, and so when you say that Gordon's work brought you all the full circle and that he came into your life just when you, same with me, I met him in Giza Death Star chat.
Wow.
I met him in Giza, and I first read that article of him. I was kind of like feeling him out. And by the way, the fourth house, talking around the fourth house being ruled by Cancer, naturally you talk around it. But I mean, just in general, and not everyone's chart, but in general, the fourth house is Cancer. So the point is that I go to meet him. Thank you for indulging my discursion. This first time I go to see him was 7/7/2017, or around then. I go out to the Chaotic Good, and when I'm out there, I'm with my roommate. We stay with a couple of supers. I'll keep them in on for now, out of just respect, you know, respect. But when I went out there, my roommate and I ended up, he had wanted to go to the what do you call the observatory right in front of the sign, the Griffith Observatory, for like 19 years, his whole life. My dude, he loves the Mekons. Cool dude. But we go out there in front of, seriously, there's so much cutting out. We get there in front of the Griffith Observatory between Chaotic Good and the members drinks night. We're out there on 7/7 in the middle of Hollywood desert. There's a statue of Herschel right in front of the building. You know what I'm talking about. Yep. So, and we're smoking weed out there in front where they feel with rebel without a cause, feeling like we're rebels without, anyways, where it's legal in California. But anyways, so yeah. Thank you for letting me tie that back around. Cause you and I both had he came into our life when we needed him. And there's some weird coming back around to the beginnings of things like, and Shark of the Desire. Here's the other indulgence. They'll bring it to the modern moment. I'm going to see Gordon in about 4 or 5 days for the members' drinks, this time around in New York.
Right on.
And the name of the event that I'm doing, that I'm going to, is, oh my gosh, what's the necessary title of it? It's basically Manifesting Your Desire, but it's, but the Shark of Desire. But gosh, what's the name of the Rune Soup event in New York? Does anyone?
The Metaphysics of Desire.
Thank you. So Metaphysical Shark Week. yeah, man. So that's what's up. I like these synchronicities. All right kind on. Like I could tell you, I can only talk about this other stuff afterwards, but it has to do with Tool. It has to do with Australia, and it's really and it has to do with the Cancer, Trump, the Chariot, and Sevens. So it just gets super freaking crazy, but I can't talk about it right now.
Cool. Anyway,
so let's ask you another one of our questions. We're moving right along. We're getting towards the twilight of our era. Is that the name? Anyways, so another question for you. This is question the four, I believe, since we asked you about your place, your food, and your music. Question the four, and these are just fun questions. People like these questions. I like these questions. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite movie from when you were a kid?
Blade Runner.
Nice. Sick answer, dude. You really, Blue Oyster Cult, Blade Runner, synchronicity we were talking about yesterday. And the original title for Blade Runner is?
Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Boom, baby, the PKD.
St. PKD.
People love those movies in the pop culture. It's like one of those things where like the source is so cool that you can only give it to the, you know, you have to like spoon feed them. I'm just talking in generals, people.
Right.
And so like, you know, it's like, and then you release it like later after. No, that's another thing, man. What do you think about the whole thing with Star Wars, like crucifying and murdering and killing Han Solo, basically, like killing the dad figure that way? Like, do you think there's something to that archetype happening there?
Absolutely. There's some resonance there. I think, you know, it's a call back to Luke battling his own father, and Vader killing Obi-Wan, who is like a father to him. It's a theme in the movies, and I think Rian Johnson did a really good job of extracting those themes and then situating them in ways to kind of flip some tables over. And you know, I don't want to say subvert expectations, because but to diffuse some of the concepts in Star Wars that they might want to move away from going forward into whatever Star Wars future they have. There's a real hard core part of the fan base that has, I'll say, maybe a little bit of an unhealthy obsession with bloodlines and hierarchies and that sort of thing.
I am not even familiar with that. I fan like Firefly and Doctor Who, and like
see it expressed in the fan, like Rey. Everybody was so shocked that her parents were nobodies, and I loved that whole idea of it subverting that. Oh, you have to be born from somebody to wield power. You have to have some dynasty. You have to command some kind of legacy to wield power, to influence your destiny, to find a place in the world. And I like that about Rey, that she subverts and deconstructs that whole idea. And it does, it's a concept that brings balance to the story.
Hmm. What could we say for that as far as like bringing it to Blade Runner, and how is a parallel not so much of like nobles and the classes of, you know, bloodlines being the archetypal dominance, but rather that of human versus machine?
Well, the sequel has some interesting things to say about that in the subtext, Blade Runner 2049.
I have not seen it yet, but that wasn't actually PKD material, was it?
One of the things that they get into in the movie that they don't really talk about, they don't spell it out, it's in the subtext, but mankind is leaving Earth behind. Earth is just this wasted, desiccated husk of a world that's covered with urban sprawl, and life as struggling to hold on. And mankind, through the corporations, is colonizing the worlds. And one of the big problems the corporations have is there's not enough humans to actually colonize all the planets that they have access to. And one of the things you, if you pay attention to the movie, you'll start to notice that there are replicants everywhere, and that the minority on the planet is the people. And the
people in
positions of power and command lots of replicants in society, but they're still there, the leftover of humanity, while the true humans, in a Gnostic sense, I guess, the archonic corporate humans are out in a diaspora taking over the galaxy.
I mean, I have to say that my only response to that as an idea is that we have this planet, and do not for a second think that any secret space fund is actually going to making things that are going off the planet. This is my opinion. But dig into this Earth, no pun intended, heal this Earth, take care of this Earth, find a way wherever the black budget's going to fund it so it becomes a green budget, so it's gold, so we can see it in the light, so we disinfect it, so it becomes green because it's only black because it's all hidden and desiccated and pustulant. Yeah. So all I'm saying is I don't think we can travel off this planet, my friend. I do not, as we, I'm not going to get into my whole cosmology. We did speak privately, and you understand that I'm just going to speak as I am right now. We are not going anywhere. If you, I'm not talking at Alan right now. I'm just, it's a listener. We are not going anywhere. This is our planet. Humans need the Earth just as much as Earth needs the humans. I feel like if we stop existing, maybe it's the tree falling in the woods. Maybe the Earth is here, but what do you know, huh, Chappie? But the point is all I'm saying is that don't think that you can beat up your family and just go to another house. Don't think as above, so below is going to ignore you there. Do not think for a second that another planet is the answer, because you're just going to give that one cancer and trash that one too. So it has to start as above, so below with the beginning. Fix yourself and the planet you're on. That's an extension of our manifestation. Mm-hmm. This plane ET, this plane T, whatever this realm of the hologram is, you're not going anywhere. If you think you're going somewhere in a spaceship, they probably have you like in that episode of Fringe where Olivia's in that box. Anyways, I've just said a lot, and I really feel like I should stop right there before I say anything else, because this is actually some RS. So anyways, and that's real shit, not ruined suit brothers and sisters. But so another question for you is, who's your favorite superhero?
Ooh, my favorite superhero. There's so many, and I grew up with comic books, so it's a pretty heavy question. I'm a DC guy. I grew up with DC comics and really dig them, and I've always enjoyed Wonder Woman. I've always liked how she was rooted in mythology, and it, later as I grew up and learned about who made Wonder Woman and the kind of relationships he had and how that inspired things in Wonder Woman's character. Things that are woven in so deeply that you can't separate them out without taking the character apart. I think that's really interesting, including all the things that people have problems with her. And she's just a really fascinating character that always generates a response from somebody. People love her, people hate her, but she's iconic and important in a way that I think Superman and Batman and a lot of other superheroes just don't really approach.
So she's undeniable, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
She's awesome.
She's, you know, there's a lot of talk about the Babylon and goddesses and that sort of thing. And I've always considered her to be part of that archetype. And in recent writing, they've brought her fully into deityhood and made her a goddess and an Olympian and all of that.
Because she's Athena, basically, or something to that effect, right?
Basically, yeah, she's like a war goddess, but she's all about wisdom and love, so that would make her very Athena.
I'm not
sure where they're at in the current continuity or anything like that. That was just the last place she was at when I looked in on her.
I am a big fan of that. I'll say further that I'm a the word devotee is never, you know, from what we learned, it's not exactly what we could say, but I keep practice with Hecate. I respect and adore and honor Hecate. And Hecate is a force that I would love to see Wonder Woman be portrayed as, like to see her somehow be all three, you know, and see if she could, like, wow, wouldn't that be something if somehow
fascinating if
Wonder Woman could even be like, and like they could parallel dimension it, they could warp universe it, but like maybe there's like the dark Wonder Woman and the red Wonder Woman, which is kind of like the chaos, and then the white Wonder Woman, and then
there's a lot of tension with that character with the source material itself. If you go back to like Homer and Hesiod, you know, the character of Wonder Woman is she's at odds just by the nature of her being an Amazon. She's at odds with characters like Hercules. She's at odds with Ares, of course, and it's interesting how that's baked into a lot of the problems that we've been talking about, culture and evil, and how you know it when you see it in relationships and things like that.
The power because like power structures are part of like how we understand ourselves, and like hierarchies, and like the parents have the power and they're teaching us things, and oh look, they have the they understand the terrain, they can manipulate it, and so oh I should do what they do because I want to manipulate the terrain in said fashion and to some degree, you know. But that makes me think of what was it? One of the things I've taken a course called autonomy. It's literally about learning how to do business things, how to respect people's time and time. It's basically adult school. It's called autonomy. It's how to become autonomous. And one of the cool things that this group of people attracts is types of people who enjoy discussing books. And one of the first things, a subgroup in autonomy set up was a discussion about the Iliad. And it is interesting to see how these gods and the way that these forces are seen and how they interplay and how much you can actually, and why I think people who are seen as like secret societies are so well read in classics is because there's some way of deeply understanding what we might call Jungian psychology or even real high strangeness that I'm not even prepared to like look up and see like a gigantic ass Athena, like, whoa, yes, madam. Yes. Yes. Anyways, no insight to anyone's psychology there whatsoever, Freud. What? But the point is that when we see these things that could be that real or just could be our psychology, I think it's a very important and potently, just so people hear me, your answer is extremely freaking cool and provoking and necessary. I love your response.
Thank you.
So question, was that the fifth one? I'm losing track now. I believe it was their fifth one because I asked you your hero, and before that I asked you about Ike Vault. Do you remember what I asked you for the fourth question? There was the one before that, yeah?
Fourth question was favorite food?
No, that was earlier.
No, that was third.
Wow. So at least it's not, I believe there was another one. I'm almost quite sure of it. Yeah, but you were answering the one before.
My favorite
that.
Movie.
I was about to say the favorite kid movie. It was a Star Wars thing. Yeah, you can vote.
Blade Runner is my favorite.
Sorry, but we got discursed into the Star Wars. Yeah, but Blade Runner was.
Blade Runner is miles and miles away from Star Wars.
Oh, I'm not questioning. Although Han Solo is in both, interestingly enough.
That's true.
Wow.
Crosses worlds.
I meant, what's his name? Freaking Harrison Ford.
Right. Yeah.
Han Solo's in both. Well, that tells you which role kind of trumps the other one, Decker. Sorry, but it's not his fault. You know who's are you familiar with Miguel Connor of Aeon Byte?
Oh yeah.
Am I being ridiculous? We've talked about this before. I'm sorry. This is probably obvious. That was just a lead in, folks. I didn't just have a complete brain gap. Oh boy. So, anyways, let me say that he likes to talk about PKD a lot, and that would be another fun conversation. I can tell that you two would. have good chemistry. That I would love to do a round table. Now I'm just taking your time. Drake, you came on the show. Now you're talking all the anyways. Let me ask you about my Jupiter and Saturn, because this is something I almost forgot to bring up during this, but we keep seeing that we have this Jupiter Saturn thing. And I've been taught, this is where people were doing some astrology talk now. Occult nerdiness is about to happen. It's on. When I've been taught about the ability of planets to express themselves, some of them are in better places than others. We mentioned the sun going into Libra and how we call it the fall in the northern hemisphere, what we call the northern hemisphere, because we're the one that's right side up. Everything else is upside down down there. I'm telling you, it's actually true. You dig a hole to China. It's real. Go try it. I'll show you the bridge. So the point is that when you see that, I did that thing where my brain just started going, where was I going right there? The Jupiter Saturn thing.
Jupiter and Saturn.
Yep. Wow. I told you I can step into a room and do, I can confuse people. I have very good nip. I can just, what the hell just happened? Did it just get weird in here? Is it just everything? And so, when you look at Jupiter and Saturn in my chart, you're taught that like the sun goes into the fall and the sun's no longer, it's either in its detriment, its fall, it's benefic, and it's dominion or something like that. There's too good, too bad, and then a bunch of neutrally in-betweens. But the two worst for the sun, I believe, are, I forget the other, I think it's Gemini and Libra. I forget the other one for the sun right now. I'm sorry. It's not Gemini, maybe. But the point is that for Jupiter is in its worst place in Capricorn in general. But you've been talking to me about the Egyptian system, and I wanted to dig a little bit for our astro nerds and people who are just might not be familiar with the Egyptian aspect, and maybe I can learn a little more about what Jupiter's doing in my life, especially with regards to Saturn.
Well, Jupiter in his fall in Capricorn.
It's okay to give away the degree for people. Like, I'm a Pisces rising.
I'll just keep it to the Jupiter's within his Egyptian bound or term within the sign of his fall on your chart. And that doesn't change the fact that Jupiter's fallen. And fallen is different than detriment. Fallen affects the reputation of a planet, not so much its ability to function, especially when it's within its own term within a sign. A planet has access to all that sign's resources. So Jupiter has access to the resources of Capricorn and even has reception from Saturn in your chart. So Saturn is there to give permission to Jupiter to use those resources. But those resources aren't the kind of resources that Jupiter likes to use. And it's not the kind of resources that people expect Jupiter to use. So Jupiter can act in Capricorn and Jupiter can signify in Capricorn from that bound, but it's, and you'll be free to act, but these decisions in this area of your life may not be the most popular.
Which is ironic, as I mentioned, the whole reason I mentioned all the Pisces rising is that makes that my 11th house for Capricorn. That's interesting.
Isn't it? Yeah, astrology is endlessly fascinating, and it's such a massive topic.
Well, I think it's incredibly credible because, I mean, one of the mediums that I'm efficacious through is, of course, what we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. And these might not be, people might not expect jovial Jupiter to spread like the darker subconscious aspects of things.
True. But
if we're going to heal, like take that ibocaine until our fear inoculant. Oh man,
sure.
I just
sometimes the sky has thunderclouds.
Yeah, well, I like what I just did there. Is take your ibogaine until you're immune to it. Take your fear inoculant. Just like, oh man, I like how that came around. But you're sure. Right, because this, you know, and if you're with someone that you love, and they're going through a hard aspect, be there to soothe their way. Be there to keep the light so that their path is steady out of that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's helping someone watch the weather change, I think, just to tie that all around to all of that. Mm-hmm. Question the last, if you're all right with that.
Sure.
I mean, we can talk about the last six question for the Six of Swords. What is your favorite period of our known history?
Oh, that would be Hellenistic Egypt and Alexandria. You know, I'd like to attend classes by Hypatia, taught to, you know, Gnostic heretical rabbis, and, you know, study with Theban sorcerers and all of that great shit that went on in Alexandria, you know.
Well, you know what our job is, of course, since it seems that both you, I, and Miguel, and Gordon all mentioned today, happen to have an affinity for this conceptualization of what we're calling Alexandria. Maybe it's time, as part of one of our many responsibilities, to have a real Alexandria, not so just virtual, as our good friend Miguel will say, but lived in praxis, and even because it has to be off the computer. We have to love. Yeah. There has to be the real exchange of feeling and care.
Mm-hmm. And harmony. Yeah, we have to manifest it.
That's why these meetups are so, I'm so psyched for it. Like, dude, like I don't know if, well, anyways, let me get back to this, the astrology in a second, but like traveling to like Hollywood or to New York, that's not what I usually do, but to like, to meet up with Gordon, to share the air, to be there in the harmony,
mm-hmm.
I ask for that. That's enough to get there.
Right.
I wanted to ask you something, tying it back around, to the, and thank you for that answer. I feel like that's a Wonder Woman answer. That was molto bene. Molto bene. Anyways, now I'm being self-referential and getting caught in an ego loop. All right, hello, I'm back. So the point is that, like, oh shit, I kind of lost my thread there. I was gonna tie back to what I was saying about prior to the Alexandria thing, I think. Oh well. Did you hear what I was starting to say before I got distracted by myself?
Oh,
that's a tall order.
I'm starting to.
Yeah, it's okay. I think we're drawing towards the near end. I think this is good. Because, like, I had a point that I'll listen to the tape afterwards and I'll probably extend upon in, like, the closing of this. Because we're still, this is the podcast still, we're still talking. Sure. Meta enough. But, yeah, I guess we'll close it down for now, because I think Alan and I both get the sense that there's more to be done. But right now we can take a pause, regroup, and build up from here. But, yeah, I really did feel like there was something we were going with. I wanted to address the point. Okay, I got one last thing. We'll end it all on this.
Okay.
Indulge me, if you will, just a little further on this Saturn and Jupiter thing I have going on.
Sure.
I'd love hearing about this, and other people are going to learn. This is how crazy it gets. And if you know about astrology already, then you're going to hear some cool stuff about a chart. You said Saturn is benefic towards, because it's a sextile. And I'm going to give the positions right now just of these two. My Saturn, for the listener, is 13 degrees Scorpio, and that is the, I believe, a ninth house for me, and the Jupiter we talked about is 4 degrees cap, so that's 11th house, so 9/11 there. What can we say is going on, since it's well aspected with that? Maybe how could I use this information to help the show and to help the listeners and to help do my musical career and
and relationship
my,
between
well, and I guess my final thing, and to write my book. I just had to finish saying that. Thank you.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Ready?
Yep.
Okay. The relationship between Saturn and Jupiter is contentious. I mean, you can look at the mythology and it's all there. Saturn eats Jupiter and all that stuff. And then, you know, Zeus comes back out and kills Cronos and yada, yada, yada. But, they are sect mates. They are rulers of the day with the sun. Jupiter, Saturn, and the sun work together really well in the daylight and in matters of daylight. So that's one way that you can have Saturn and Jupiter connect up and reinforce each other. And that would, you know, we're talking solar activities. So, you know, shining light into the darkness, organizing, ruling, leading, those types of things. They'll cooperate there. But as far as like, they're at odds as far as benefic and malefic, Jupiter being benefic and Saturn being malefic. So that's where the tension is going to come in. That's where it's going to be that what's good, what's bad, and what context do I use which? And with the sextile relationship between Saturn and Jupiter, that sextile is like thoughts and prayers. And it's a benefic aspect as opposed to an opposition or square aspect.
So would there be some kind of lesson or metaphor in there saying how I would best utilize my Jupiter given those two aspects or anything like that?
Capricorn is a house of, it's an earth house, earth sign.
Cardinal.
And cardinal, exactly. It's like stony earth, and you have to remove the stones from the earth to build a wall and till the earth and make a field. And it's raw resources. And Jupiter, being a fire and air type sign, planet, is better at the whole idea of ruling from above. He's not so good at being down in the dirt. This is one of the reasons why this sign is his fall.
Yeah.
But the region that he occupies is one that's good for him, or one that he can at least use. So, it seems to point towards working with what you've got and having to come down to earth.
That's interesting you say that, because the final point I was going to bring up is about the nodes, because you brought up how you were wanting to ride the shark of desire, which seems like riding in the direction of our north node.
Mm-hmm.
Or is that the true node? Is that the one that's usually represented? If the other one's not, is that the T node? Is that the one?
The true node and the mean node usually only deviate by a degree or two.
And is that, again, is that the north one then?
That's the north one and the south one. They're always 180 degrees.
Right. So does the T represent the north or the south is what I'm wondering.
North.
Just making sure. Thank you.
Sure.
And which one is Rahu and Ketu?
That's Indian astrology.
Right,
that's
right.
Outside of my own particular area of preference.
I know the concept is similar because of the nodes of the moon, and one of them's a dragon's head and the other one's a dragon's tail.
Sure,
So what's interesting is you and I have nodes that are very close to one another. Yours is in your, you said your fourth house, so that would put your 10 in your 4?
Yep.
For me, it is the 9 and the 3. By the way, I just want to make a quick thelemic excursion. I don't know if you've ever heard this interpretation, and as someone who is not strictly OTO, it's just something I happen to notice that in the zodiacal chart, we're talking about the 3rd and the 9th house, and the 9 and the 3, there's something metaphysic about the lower mundane mind and the higher spiritual mind in the 93, which is exercising between the difference between what love is and love under what people call projected will. So sure. I think there's a secret occult meaning there, and I hope that, you know, I didn't violate any blood oaths there. So anyways, my whole sheboygle, it seems like I'm coming ironically from the ninth house where my self node seems to be in Scorpio. I have a critical one. I have a 29 degree one. My Scorpio self node. So my third. My Taurus is my third house, and that's where my true node is. So I have no idea what the heck a third house Taurus 29 degree true node, it's north node, would even mean.
I mean, third house is your close relationships, your friends and family. So that's you know where the path of your fate lies with that close family community relationship. And Taurus, that is a sign of another earth sign, which puts it in the triplicity that Jupiter's in.
It's ruled by Venus too.
A third aspect towards Jupiter, trine aspect towards Jupiter. So it's hard to tell without looking at your whole chart and seeing the whole thing all together. But with Taurus, you're generally looking at it's the successive Earth house. And if you pull that back a little bit.
Yeah. So for the listener, and I may or may not edit this, you know how we do. I'm just showing my, I could always throw it in the Discord, but it's on the screen right now.
I think I still have, I can just scroll up to it. Here we go. I believe this is it.
Yeah, my, just to
Venus is the Lord of Taurus, so we have to check on her condition to see what's up there.
Yeah, I was saying Venus is Libra and Taurus, which I don't know, but like I love Taurus suns. I almost always love Taurus sun people.
Interesting. Yeah, she's in aversion to that house. So, that is it's a blind spot for you, is what that says to me.
Because she's in Venus is in a house ruled by Venus. In
absolutely, yeah. But the her two houses that she rules, and this is something that she shares with Mars, are an aversion to each other.
Wow. I don't know what that means.
Well, it creates interesting issues of reception. When they're in one domicile, the other domicile does not receive reception from the domicile lord.
Okay.
So,
it diverts the energy.
Right. And she can't see what's going on in that house.
Oh yeah.
So she can't have an influence on what goes on in that home. She's either in one or the other.
And the solution to this would be?
Well, I would have to spend more time with your chart. And also, by no means am I an expert at this. I've only been studying astrology for a couple of years.
Oh, that puts you and me in the same boat. I want to take an Austin Coppa course. I think that's the way to go if you're going to learn.
Well, I've heard really good things, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. But, I can vouch. Very talented. Very poetic. Handsome man. That's all the compliments you get right now, Austin. Three. Though more should be forthcoming. All right. Well, I don't want to kill the listener with just like my chart and stuff. I was just wondering about like in the whole, we can definitely figure this part out and then we'll.
Sure. Yeah. If you like sometime, we could talk a little more about this. I haven't done a rundown on your chart. So I would have to start at the top and go through the hierarchy of assessing the condition of the planets and everything. And do a synthesis.
I welcome that. We will do that. I guess I want to end with a last question about what you think about lords of charts. Do you have a lord of the chart that you feel connected to that has to do with your rising sign? Do you feel that like applies?
Victor or the lord of the rising sign? Or
the two different things, right? No, the lord.
The lord of the rising sign is for me is Jupiter.
You're Sagittarius?
Yes.
Oh, man. So fellow sons of Jupiter, I've had a wonderful conversation on the 10th episode of the Six of Swords. Alan Drake, thank you so much for coming on and doing this. It's been a blast. Do you have any kind of works that you want to give the people a plug to or a way to reach you or anything like that?
Nothing really going on at the moment. And I'm kind of hard to get a hold of. By design, in a lot of ways, I guess. I'm a bit of a hermit. Let's see. Nope. Just have to cast it into the wind and hope I hear.
we'll figure it out. Well, sure. Thank you so much for coming on, and we will hear from you soon, at least on these roundtables, too.
I hope you get something coherent out of me.
It was great, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for listening to our show today. This was the 10th episode of The Six of Swords. We had Alan Drake with us, and we were talking about healing and art and spirituality, as we are wont to do. So, for upcoming events, don't forget, as mentioned, we have the Invisibles Reading Group coming. There will be more details that you can find out about on the Six of Swords Discord. Any questions about that can be fielded over there at the A Garden Party thread. And for now, thank you so much for listening to the show. There's so much more coming. The Six of, well, you'll see. We have a new family member on the way. So thank you again for listening. Love always to all of my communities, from the No Agenda family, to my Gizars, to my Rune Supers, to my Freemasonic brethren, to my Rosicrucian fraternity and sorority, to the Six of Swords / Cups / Wands / you know what, listeners, whatever name we're going to eventually get ourselves, thank you. So, for now, that's the show, and I'll talk to you later.